Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. Here in California, we are witnessing a massive species loss. 95% of starfish populations have been lost between Orange County, California, and Alaska, and scientists aren't sure why this is happening. And then monarch butterfly populations are at less than 5% of their peak. Elsewhere in the country, bat populations are suffering from catastrophic deaths exceeding 5.5 million. Amphibians are dying out at an exhaustive rate over just a few years, becoming the world's most endangered class of animals. And some, like the golden frogs of Panama, now exist only in captivity. The planet has already undergone 5 major extinctions, including the asteroid that wiped out the dinosaurs. In her new book, The Sixth Extinction, today's guest, Elizabeth Colbert, writes, quote, "Scientists are currently monitoring the sixth extinction, predicted to be the most devastating since the asteroid impact that wiped out the dinosaurs. This time around, the cataclysm is us. It is estimated that 1/3 of all reef-building corals, 1/3 of all freshwater mollusks, 1/3 of sharks and rays, 1/4 of all mammals, 1/5 of all reptiles, and 1/6 of all birds are headed toward oblivion. The losses are occurring all over, in the South Pacific and in the North Atlantic, in lakes and on islands, on mountaintops and in valleys. If you know how to look, you can probably find signs of the current extinction event in your own backyard," end quote. So what will life look like after 20 to 50% of all species are eradicated? And are we too late to prevent it? What is really happening on the ground, and how could we get the public to really care about this issue? Today, we're joined by Elizabeth Colbert. She's a staff writer at The New Yorker magazine, where she covers science and the environment. She's author of Field Notes from a Catastrophe, Man, Nature, and Climate Change. And her most recent book is The Sixth Extinction, An Unnatural History. And Elizabeth joins me here in studio. Hi, Elizabeth. Thanks for coming in.
Thanks for having me.
Well, it's a really great book, really scary. You start off by writing about how you read about frogs that are disappearing in one of your children's magazines. And then you read kind of a similar article by David Wake of the University of California, Berkeley, and Vance Vredenburg, a San Francisco State professor. And they write about the mass extinctions. And they also write about the sixth extinction. And you said that the notion that a sixth such event would be taking place right now, more or less in front of our eyes, struck you, to use the technical term, as mind-boggling. And why isn't this getting more attention? So is that why you started this journey?
Yeah, I mean, I was really, really struck, especially in that article, the juxtaposition of those two articles. The first appeared in National Geographic Kids, and it was about how scientists in Panama had anticipated this disease that afflicts amphibians that was sort of racing through the rainforest, and it had killed off amphibian populations in many places, in many parts of the world already. And in this particular instance, scientists were watching it in real time move through the country, and they decided to try to scoop up some of the frogs. There's a particular species there, the Panamanian golden frog, which is a really wonderfully beautiful frog. It's a bright, bright yellow. It's very poisonous. It stands out very dramatically from the forest floor. It has these sort of slender legs and very dark eyes, which I, as I write in the book, have a very, very thoughtful look to them, actually. I can't really tell you what's going on in their minds. But anyway, they anticipated this wave of extinctions, and they scooped up a population of Panamanian golden frogs and a couple of other species, and they literally didn't have anywhere to put them at that point. So the frogs ended up living in a hotel, and this was a wonderful idea for a kids magazine, and they wrote a piece in National Geographic Kids about, you know, I think it was called The Marvelous Frog Hotel. And that was really struck me as a wonderful story right away. That was an interesting story. And I sort of heard about this amphibian crisis, and I thought, well, this is an interesting way to write about it. And then I read this other piece, as you mentioned, which appeared in the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences, which was a scholarly article about It's titled, Are We in the Midst of the Sixth Mass Extinction? The View from the World of Amphibians. And the scientists in there, both of them Californians nearby, made the argument that when you look at extinction rates among amphibians, they're astronomically high at this point. And so from the perspective of amphibians, it does look like we're in the middle of a mass extinction. And that whole concept, as you say, seemed to me not to have really... it was new to me, and it was just such an amazing thought that we were witnessing one of these very, very rare events in Earth history, and I thought, well, I've really got to write about that.
Why do you think this gets so little attention?
Well, that's a good question. I mean, on some level, you know, it's a problem that people are aware of sort of in the back of their mind. Look, a lot of things seem to be going extinct, you know, and it's, in a way, it's just putting all of those many stories that people hear, little dribs and drabs of, you mentioned some of them, monarchs, frogs, bats, the pandas, the rhinos, the elephants. You know, we can all list many, many groups that are in really serious trouble, species or whole groups of animals. And when you put it all together, I think people hear it sort of in dribs and drabs. And they sort of try to shrug it off because it's, you know, bad news. They don't really want to hear it. And what I've really tried to do in the book is put it all together in a way that makes it both interesting, I hope. It's an interesting story. It's really quite fascinating to think about what we're doing in the whole context of Earth history. And also, as you say, I hope, shocking to people, so that instead of these little dribs and drabs of information which we just shrug off, we look at this whole broader phenomenon.
And you also look at the history of the other five mass extinctions, and we'll talk about that, but you say that what makes this one different, you write that the current extinction has its own novel cause, not an asteroid or a massive volcanic eruption, but one weedy species, as Walter Alvarez put it to you, a professor in the Earth and Planetary Science Department at UC Berkeley, quote, we're seeing right now that a mass extinction can be caused by human beings.
Yes, Walter Alvarez is the scientist with his father, who was also at Berkeley and was a Nobel Prize winning physicist. They were the group that came up with the theory that an asteroid impact was what had done in the dinosaurs, and not just the dinosaurs. The dinosaurs always get top billing, but many, many groups went out in that major mass extinction at the end of the Cretaceous period about 66 million years ago. And when they came up with that theory, it was really widely derided, but it was subsequently confirmed, and it's really quite widely accepted right now. And I spoke to Walter Alvarez a few years ago, and one of the points that he made was when people sort of first realized that an asteroid impact had caused this most recent extinction event, they went back and they tried to look at previous mass extinctions, of which, you know, there had been four very, very major ones that show up in the fossil record going back some 450 million years. And they thought, well, maybe asteroid impacts have caused all of those. You know, that was a sort of working hypothesis for a while. And people went really looking for evidence of that and never succeeded in finding it. So now the general theory is, there is no general theory that mass extinctions are caused by things that are, you know, perhaps they are in fact so deadly because organisms have never encountered them before in evolutionary history. And one of the other points he made is that we are now that agent, the way that we are changing the world. And you could think about it that we are also very, very dangerous to other creatures because we are also new in evolutionary history. We're actually a very young organism, only about 200,000 years old. And certainly what we're doing now in terms of, you know, burning fossil fuels and running through a lot of resources is very, very new, you know, just really a blink of an eye in terms of evolutionary history.
What else did scientists tell you about how humans are causing this latest extinction?
Well, in the book I talk about, you know, several ways in which we're changing the planet on what would be called a geological scale. So you often hear scientists now saying, we have replaced the great geological forces that in the past reshaped the planet, and we're doing it very, very fast, much more quickly than those forces usually act. So, for example, there's also a movement among geologists to even rename the epoch that we live in. Formerly, we live in an epoch known as the Holocene, which is the period since the last ice age. It's about 12,000 years. And now a lot of scientists are saying, well, really, we no longer live in the Holocene. We live in a new time period that should be called the Anthropocene, because humans are now reshaping the planet to such an extent.
What about overpopulation? When we do shows about climate change and the environment, we get a lot of calls about population. We have a comment on our website from Linda who says, quote, all our ills are caused by overpopulation, yet this is seldom discussed. Our greed-based economies suppress this, as it is based on selling more and more people. Otherwise, the economy no longer keeps generating more. When was the last world conference on overpopulation, and what can be done?
Well, that's a huge question that, you know, it's a little bit above my pay grade, to be honest. Certainly population, you know, if you're just going to look at human impacts on the planet, you have to look at, you know, how many there are of us and how much we are all consuming. And both of those are increasing, right? So population is increasing, and how much the average person on the planet is consuming is increasing. And when both of those lines are going up simultaneously, you know, everything's going to be ramping up really, really fast. So we are using, you know, obviously just running through the planet's resources at a faster and faster rate. Now, what can be done about this? I mean, you need to unfortunately address both parts of that equation, both population and how much people are consuming, to really, you know, make a significant dent in our impacts. And I don't pretend, you know, to have the answer to that. But I agree with your, you know, with the comment that we certainly need to pay more attention to population control.
You traveled around the world to talk to scientists. Did they bring up population issues?
Well, I can't say that population per se is at top of mind right now. And I think that many scientists are focused on, okay, you know, we have 7.2 billion people on the planet. We're almost inevitably, you know, we are inevitably heading towards 8 and maybe 9, and maybe eventually population will level out. And we've got to try to deal with these problems with the population that we have, because, you know, there's just no way that we're not going to 8, and there's probably no way that we're not going to 9 without, you know, killing off, to be honest, masses of humanity, which I don't think counts as really a solution as that.
In your book, you cite a study from the University of Chicago that found evidence for the 5 major mass extinctions, including many lesser extinction events, and they appear to take place in a cycle of around 26 million years. So what is considered a mass extinction? How do we know we're in one?
Well, I should go back and say that theory that they seem to take place cyclically has really been discredited. Even the people who proposed it about 20 years ago or so have since said, you know, they don't take place cyclically. They seem to take place very randomly at very random intervals for different reasons. And the sign that you know, you are witnessing a mass extinction, you know, is very elevated extinction rates. And one, you know, there's no real, you know, this is it. This is the piece of information that tips you off. It's just across many different groups. We're not just talking about, you know, vertebrates. We're not talking about just large mammals. We're talking about all sorts of different groups. We're talking about invertebrates. We're talking about marine creatures. We're talking about land creatures. In all sorts of groups, there are very high extinction rates. And one point that I think is really important for people to understand, and it goes back to this idea that we're sort of inured to this drip, drip, drip news of extinction, is that extinction should happen very, very rarely. I point out in the book that if you're in the case of mammals, you know, people have sort of done calculations based on the fossil record, and they've calculated one mammal species should go extinct, let's say, on the order of every several hundred years. Now, we all know, you know, any school kid now can name mammals that have gone extinct or on the edge of extinction. And that suggests just the fact that you can name one tells you that something really unusual is going on.
We're speaking with Elizabeth Colbert. She's a staff writer with The New Yorker, and she's out with a new book, The Sixth Extinction, An Unnatural History. And she writes that our planet has already gone through five major extinctions, including the one that wiped out the dinosaurs. But this time, humans are the culprit, potentially eradicating 20 to 50% of all living species within this century. So if you have any questions about this extinction, we'd love to hear from you. And as Elizabeth said, she was shocked to read about the fact that we're going through this and it's not getting more publicity. So what can we do to get the public to really talk about this issue? Well, at a time when people in the national media are still questioning climate change, which I'd love to talk to you about that also during the show. If you work in the field of the environment, if you work on these kinds of issues, what are you seeing? What really concerns you? And what do you think can be done about this? The toll-free number is 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org or leave a comment on our website, yourcallradio.org. So when you looked at past extinctions, what really struck you in terms of the differences between those extinctions and what we're going through now?
Well, those extinctions, as far as we know, certainly were all caused by some kind of, you know, what we would call geological change. So, for example, the extinction, the worst mass extinction in the history of the planet, or in the history of the last half a billion years, and the reason that scientists choose half billion years is sort of the beginning point for this saga, is that that's when complicated animals evolve. That's when we start to get a fossil record of multicellular animals. And the very worst one occurred about 250 million years ago. It's called the end Permian extinction. It killed off something like 90% of the species on Earth, and there's, you know, some people have pointed out it's sometimes called the mother of all mass extinctions, that it came pretty close to wiping out multicellular life and sort of putting us back into this Earth where only, you know, microbial life existed. And that seems to have been caused by a sort of massive burst of volcanic activity in what's now Siberia. And that emitted tremendous amounts of CO2. And it changed the climate, and it changed the chemistry of the oceans. And frighteningly, really frighteningly, one of the most frightening things I've encountered in doing reporting for this book are scientists, very serious scientists, increasingly comparing what we're doing by emitting massive amounts of CO2 and changing the climate and changing the chemistry of the oceans to what happened at the end of the Permian period. And there really can't be a more sobering, you know, analog than that. So the difference, obviously, though, is in that case we had, you know, an unsentient force, volcanic activity at work, and in this case we have a sentient creature at work, which is humanity.
What about resiliency? Because a lot of people say, well, it's all resilient, and in the end, everything will be okay. You write that what this history reveals in its ups and downs is that life is extremely resilient, but not infinitely so. There have been very long, uneventful stretches and very, very occasionally revolutions on the surface of the Earth. So what did you learn about resiliency?
Well, I think anyone out in the field, you know, any biologist, any paleontologist will tell you that what the history of life seems to show is that life is very tough. You know, there's been life on this planet, multicellular life, for 500, you know, million years. It's diversified to the level that, you know, we have today, or at least had until, you know, relatively recent times, which was a sort of high in global history. So life is always getting sort of more complicated and more diverse and more fantastic, if you want to use that word. And it's very, very tough, and creatures have to be very tough. They wouldn't have survived, you know, until now if they weren't. And, you know, and there really truly is survival of the fittest, as Darwin told us. But you can have these moments where, for whatever reason, you push things to the breaking point. And obviously, if we are doing that, that is really, you know, there can't be anything more serious that's going on the planet right now, because we are very, no matter, you know, how high-tech we are all implicated in nature. I don't really take a position in the book. It's a very interesting question. Are we really part of nature or apart from nature? But certainly we are dependent on natural systems. We breathe oxygen, you know, which is produced by natural systems. We are dependent on the nitrogen cycle, on the water cycle. You're having a terrible drought here in California. People are going to become painfully aware of the ways, you know, that we're dependent on these natural systems.
Well, we have a caller who has a question about technology. So let's hear from Polly in Rio del Mar. Hi, welcome to the show.
Yes, hi. It's Tali with a T.
Oh, hi. Sorry, Tali.
Yeah, that's right. Yes, I've heard Elizabeth on other shows in the last couple of weeks, and very impressed with her commitment to, you know, bringing this to the public. And I was wondering if I haven't heard her speak anything about the effect of the exponential increase in the use of wireless and from radiation from everything from satellite, all the drones, the satellites that run everything around the planet. And the all the way down to cell phones, cordless phones, Wi-Fi, et cetera. I've also learned that you can stop the heart of a frog with a cell phone. I wondered also if you've looked into the research that Warnke, the Warnke, the researcher, the scientist from Germany, who's been studying 30 years, I believe, about how a colony collapse is happening throughout the world, and it's potentially mainly caused by wireless.
Well, I'm not at all. I would never claim to be an expert on, you know, on wireless technology and the impacts it's having, though. I did write a piece several years ago when colony collapse disorder, was first really chronicled, and I have to say that in reporting that piece, I came to the conclusion, and I believe that most scientists have come to the conclusion that wireless is not the problem. The problem is probably much more mundane, as it were, pesticides and diseases. But it does remain still rather mysterious why we saw colony collapse disorder emerge at that particular moment.
Well, thanks for calling in, Tali. We're actually planning a week-long series about the electronic soup that we're all living in. So we're going to be discussing the issues that you brought up, and that's scheduled for a couple of weeks from now. So be sure to tune in for that. It's going to be a whole week-long series. So thank you for calling. Let's go next to Wanda in Berkeley. Hi, Wanda. Welcome to the show.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I wanted to mention, I heard on Pete Seeger's 90th birthday, I think it was, when he was interviewed by Amy Goodman, he said if the world can just stop the scientists from making another weapon of mass destruction, we might have a chance. And I really believe that scientists are putting this on the average human being. They've made all of these pesticides, which they just put out into the environment, and they put GMOs out there. We've got, you know, back in the day, they used to blow up nuclear bombs in the ionosphere, and now they use HARP, and they put aerosols in the atmosphere. And the other day, I heard Elizabeth Colbert on Terry Gross's program talking about how she was, you know, hanging out with Ken Caldiera, chief geoengineer. You know, I mean, he advocates putting aerosols into the atmosphere and experimenting on, you know, screening the sun with aluminum oxide and things like that. Now, I just think the scientists need to be called on their participation. They're the ones who are doing this, and they're trying to put it on the average human for our fossil fuel consumption. It's not just CO2. CO2 is not a toxin. It is something that, you know, I believe in climate change, but I don't believe it's being caused by that. I believe it's being caused what scientists are doing.
Well, thank you for calling in, Wanda. We actually had Ken Caldiera on the show. We did a debate about geoengineering, and you spent time with Ken in the Great Barrier Reef.
Yeah, we went to a wonderful, wonderful place called One Tree Island, where they were...
You know, actually, I'm sorry. I just realized we have to go to break.
Sure.
That was actually one of my favorite parts of your book. We're going to take a break, and Wanda, when we come back, we'll address your question. Today, we are speaking with Elizabeth Colbert about the sixth extinction in unnatural history. Scientists say that we're in the middle of a mass extinction, so what can we do to get this more attention? We'll be back after this.
V. This is Your Call on Local Public Radio 91.7 KALW San Francisco. We'd love to hear your perspective. You can join today's conversation by calling 866-798-8255. It's a toll-free call, 866-798-TALK. If you'd rather write than call, you can send an email, comment, or question to feedback@yourcallradio.org, or you can simply post a comment there at the website, yourcallradio.org. Coming up in 30 minutes at 11, World Have Your Say from the BBC, here on KALW.
This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Coming up tomorrow, it's our Friday Media Roundtable. We'll have a conversation with Aloof Ben, a veteran journalist covering foreign policy and national security. He's also editor-in-chief of Haaretz in Israel. We will talk with him about how Israeli journalists cover the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. We'll also talk about the role that the U.S. media play in shaping public opinion about that important issue. So that's tomorrow. Be sure to tune in. And if you have a guest idea or a show idea, you can drop us a line, feedback at yourcallradio.org. Today we are speaking with Elizabeth Colbert. She's a staff writer with The New Yorker magazine. She's out with a new book called The Sixth Extinction, An Unnatural History. Our planet has already gone through five major extinctions, and the sixth one is predicted to be the most devastating since the asteroid that wiped out the dinosaurs. Elizabeth tells us why and how human beings have altered life on the planet in a way no species has before, and she says we need to rethink the fundamental question of what it means to be human. So if you have any questions or comments about extinctions, if you work on conservation issues and you'd like to talk about what you're seeing out in the field, we'd love to hear from you. The toll-free number is 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. How can we get the public to pay attention to this when you've got, like, Meet the Press, for example, had a so-called debate about climate change last Sunday, and I'm going to ask Elizabeth about that in a little bit, but you've got the national media still debating climate change while we're in the middle of this extinction, according to scientists. So how can we get the public to actually pay attention and care about this issue? The toll-free number is 866-798-8255. Do you want to address Wanda's concerns about, you know, geoengineering and pesticides and those issues?
Well, I think there were a lot of issues that Wanda raised, and I one, just make the point, you know, neither that science is just a method, right? What is science? It's a method of inquiry. And yes, it's produced a lot of, you know, everything that we depend on really for modern life, you know, from electricity to engines to, you know, a lot of our crops have been a product of the scientific method, I suppose you could say. And you can say, well, all of that, you know, is really unfortunate, and we should never have embarked on this project. But I'm not sure, you know, you can really blame scientists who are, you know, just pursuing their research for that. And to what use we as a society put a lot of scientific discoveries to that. I'm going to say that really is our responsibility. I'm not willing to fob that off on scientists. How's that?
She also brought up CO2, and you write that humans are constantly adding CO2 to the seas, much as vents do, but from above rather than below. This year alone, the oceans will absorb 2.5 billion tons of carbon. Next year, it's expected they will absorb another 2.5 billion tons. Every day, every American, in effect, pumps 7 pounds of carbon into the sea.
Yes, this is the phenomenon known as ocean acidification. And just to go back to Wanda's point for a moment, the idea that carbon dioxide is not causing climate change, that something else is causing climate change, I just can't say strongly enough that carbon dioxide is causing climate change. It is the greenhouse gas that is most responsible for climate change right now. We're pumping about 10 billion metric tons of carbon into the air by burning fossil fuels. There are other greenhouse gases that we're also adding to the atmosphere. Some are more powerful than CO2 even, for example, methane. But CO2 is really the number one culprit right now, and the number one cause of that is that we're burning a lot of fossil fuels, coal, oil, and natural gas. And I just can't really state strongly enough that that is, you know, basically as much of a fact as we've got around these days. And, you know, you alluded to before the idea that this is being debated, which is completely crazy, you know, whether CO2 is causing climate change. We've understood that CO2 is a greenhouse gas for 150 years. So there's really no news here. And the flip side of climate change is that when we pour CO2 into the atmosphere, we also effectively pour it into the oceans, because wherever the water and the air meet, they exchange gases. So we are basically pumping a lot of CO2 into the water and into the oceans. And what's important to realize about that is that when you dissolve CO2 in water, you get an acid. It's a weak acid. We drink it. You know, when you drink a Coke, you're drinking it, but it's an acid. And we are changing the chemistry of the oceans. And interestingly enough, even people who, you know, quote unquote, debate climate change, which I have to say is simply at this point a ridiculous debate, cannot debate the fact that we're changing the chemistry of the oceans. It's measurable. It's very simple chemistry. You never hear anyone debate that. And it's having devastating effects.
Well, and after I read the intro of your book, I jumped to the section about the Great Barrier Reef, because I love the ocean and I'm a huge lover of underwater life. And I mean, this is the most important part of your book, I think, because Ken Caldera said, quote, "Corals build the architecture of the ecosystem. So it's pretty clear if they go, the whole ecosystem goes." And then according to a trio of British scientists, it is likely that reefs will be the first major ecosystem in the modern era to become ecologically extinct. You went to One Tree Island, a research station in the Great Barrier Reef, and I loved the description when you first went snorkeling. First off, it sounds amazing. What did that look like?
Yeah, it was really one of the sort of paradoxes of reporting this book, which is about the ways in which human impacts on the planet right now are virtually inescapable. One of these sort of ironies was that I went to the ends of the earth, really. One Tree Island is, you know, about as remote as you can get, I guess. It's a tiny little island. It just pokes above the waves of the Great Barrier Reef. It's really effectively on the reef. You're really living on the reef when you're there. And it's a wonderful, wonderful place. And it's about as intact as reefs are at this point, which, you know, is very hard for us to have a baseline, because we just don't know exactly what was there, say, even 50 years ago. Although we do know that the Great Barrier Reef is declining pretty rapidly. That's, it's lost something like 50% of its coral cover just in the last 30 years, which is a shocking, shocking figure. And we would go out snorkeling when the scientists weren't, you know, doing their research. They loved to go snorkeling. And when you just jump off the boat and look down, I don't dive. Some of them dive, but I was just going snorkeling. You see this sort of shimmering world beneath you, the most fantastic colors and shapes, a fish of really, you know, that you couldn't really even imagine if you were trying to come up with, you know, crazy fish, rays and turtles and sharks. And corals actually also are very, very colorful, many different, you know, pinks and yellows and greens and sort of purples. And it's just a wonderfully, wonderfully rich world. It really doesn't even have an analog on land. You know, people talk about coral reefs being the rainforest of the marine realm. But I've actually now been to the rainforest, and coral reefs are very, very special, because when you're in the rainforest, you really don't see much animal life. You just see this very, very dense foliage. But when you're looking down onto a coral reef, you see this profusion of life that is really just takes your breath away.
One Tree is a tiny research station operated by the University of Sydney, and you write that scientists from all over the world flock there because of what you just described, and it really tells them what we're facing and what's to come.
Yes, I mean, scientists go there for all different reasons, and I record in the book some of they have this tradition now of they write on the walls of the research station. Every team that comes in writes sort of a slogan and an emblem, and teams had come from all over the world to study all sorts of different things. They've come to study why there are certain animals that fluoresce. They'd come to take cores of a coral reef. If you take a core of a coral reefs, you know, are constantly sort of accreting layers, and so you can learn a lot by coring down. You can learn a lot about the history of the reef from that. They'd come to study, you know, worms and sea cucumbers and fish and what you name it. People had come to study it.
We're speaking with Elizabeth Colbert about her new book, The Sixth Extinction, An Unnatural History. She tells us why and how human beings have altered life on the planet in a way no species has. So what, if anything, can be done about this? What is being done about this? What questions do you have about the sixth extinction? If you work in conservation, we'd love to hear from you. Or on climate change issues, the toll-free number is 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org or leave a comment on our website. And let's go to Donald in San Francisco. Hi, Donald. Welcome to the show.
Hello. Hi, Rose.
Hi.
I'm just would be very interested to hear your guests' comments about carbon dioxide. I think there's little doubt the climate is changing, but personally, I've got my doubts about whether we're causing it. And the reason for that is simply the numbers of carbon dioxide. There's no question carbon dioxide is a very soluble gas and goes into the ocean like your guest described. But just in terms of absolute numbers, there's for every molecule of carbon dioxide in the air, there's 10,000 in the ocean. So when your guest says we put out, you know, 50 pounds or whatever the number that she describes, which is quite true, when you compare that with the total amount of carbon dioxide already dissolved in the ocean, it's minuscule. And I would argue that it's a bit like comparing water vapor. I mean, water vapor is actually a very strong greenhouse gas as well. I don't disagree carbon dioxide is a greenhouse gas, but my doubts apply to our contribution. Like,
yeah, that's a good question. Yeah. You're actually identifying one of the reasons that it actually took scientists quite a while to sort of take the problem of ocean acidification seriously, because a lot of people assumed, much as you're assuming, well, there's a whole lot of CO2 already in the ocean, so what we're doing can't really be making that much of a difference. But it simply turns out that it does, that it gets absorbed in the surface waters of the ocean. It exhausts the buffering capacity ions. I'm not going to go into the chemical equations here, but it exhausts that, and it is acidifying the oceans. We can measure that. That is something, you know, that we can watch go on, and it's also something that you can calculate. Once again, these are very sophisticated calculations. I don't even pretend, you know, that I could emulate them, but very, very smart people are doing these things, and I'm afraid we're just going to have to, unless people want to go into, you know, very, very sophisticated marine chemistry and educate themselves, we're going to have to trust what these people are telling us. And the same thing, I should say, about climate models and CO2. The caller is absolutely right. Water vapor is a very important greenhouse gas. And one of the effects that we're having, in fact, by putting carbon dioxide into the atmosphere, is that we are increasing the water vapor content of the atmosphere. And that is also built into climate models. Climate modelers understand that. You know, people often sort of assume that other people aren't thinking about what they're thinking about. And I can only assure your caller that scientists are thinking of all of these issues that he's raised.
You visited an island with naturally occurring carbon dioxide, but the name of the island escapes me right now.
It's a teeny little island. It's called Castello Aragonese, and it's named after a huge castle that's built on top. It's off the coast of Italy. It's off of Naples.
And what did you find there?
That was a really interesting place. That was a place where a British scientist named Jason Hall Spencer had once gone swimming. And this is an area with a lot of volcanic activity. You know, Mount Vesuvius is nearby, and there's just a lot of volcanic activity in the area. These are all volcanic islands, in fact. And there are vents at the bottom of the sea. You can see them. There's a lot of sort of bubbles coming up. And it turns out that the gas that they're venting is almost pure carbon dioxide. And he had this idea, look, here's a part of the ocean that has already a sort of unusually high CO2 content and an unusually low pH. If you remember your, you know, high school chemistry, pH is a measure of acidity. And if I look at what's happened here, I sort of have a time machine. I can see what's going to happen as we continue to add carbon dioxide to the oceans. Here we already see what the effects of that are. And he did this interesting experiment where he took a census of all the marine life around the island. So near these vents, up close to these vents, and far away from the vents. And what he found was that far away from the vents, where the ocean chemistry is pretty typical for the Mediterranean these days, you know, he counted all the creatures and, you know, the number, let's just say roughly, of animal species and plant species was, I think it was around 120 that they could see, things that you could see with a naked eye. And then as you got closer and closer to the vents, more and more creatures started to drop out. And the real sort of takeaway from this experiment was that at the level of ocean acidification that we are expected to reach by the end of this century, if we, you know, continue on our merry way, just dumping CO2 into the atmosphere and subsequently into the oceans, a third of the species drop out. They cannot survive conditions like that. So that is a pretty sobering figure that, you know, by the end of this century, we could see a third of marine creatures no longer able to cope with marine chemistry.
What does that mean for the rest of the planet?
Well, you ask a very good question. I don't think anyone really knows, but I can only say that, you know, a collapse of ocean food webs, you know, we're already to a certain extent seeing that, and we see, you know, fish catches and declining as a result. But, you know, what that means really in terms of to life on land, I'm not sure anyone really has a good idea. But we do know that changes in marine chemistry have been associated, you know, with some of these big, big extinction events of the past.
All right. Well, thank you for calling in, Donald. And let's go next. Go to our next caller, Barbara and Elsa Bronte. Hi, Barbara.
Hi.
Hi, you're on the air.
Okay, sorry.
That's okay.
Now, I'm thinking about what she was just saying. The UC Museum of Paleontology at Cal in Berkeley on March 1st is having a short course entitled "Where Have All the Species Gone?" And that might be of interest. There's still space available, which is remarkable. But last year I participated in a small week-long conference that pointed out how the amphibian die-off around the world is just startling and very disturbing. And I think part of the reason that there just isn't enough education about this for people. There isn't enough to bring the general public enough resources to bring the general public into realizing how serious the situation is. And I think part of the problem is just a lack of education on the part of humans.
Yeah, well, thank you. I really loved the chapter about amphibians and just the facts you share. You write that amphibians are the planet's great survivors. The ancestors of today's frogs crawled out of the water 400 million years ago. And by 250 million years ago, the earliest representatives of what would become the modern amphibian orders, one includes frogs and toads, the second newts and salamanders, and the third weird limbless creatures called caecilians, have evolved. You also write that several common North American frogs, including spring peppers, are able to survive the winter frozen solid like popsicles.
Yeah, you know, amphibians are incredibly adaptable, and that is why when scientists, and, you know, we talked about some of the scientists here in California who were among the first to really sound the alarm on what's become known as the amphibian crisis, they exist in all sorts of habitats on 6 of the 7 continents. They're an amazingly diverse and and seemingly resourceful group, you know, that have survived several mass extinctions already. And so the fact that amphibians are in so much trouble right now really, at first, really perplexed people. They were like, well, amphibians are tough. They're very, very hardy. What is going on here? And it took quite a while, actually, to sort of figure things out.
And Barbara, we'll get to your question in just a minute, because I think it's a good last question. But before we do that, I wanted to talk quickly about human transportation. You write about how we're creating a new Pangaea, which is erasing millions of years of geographic separation. We're running geologic history backward and at high speed. As our transportation improves, we introduce new non-native species, sometimes intentionally, sometimes not. During any given 24-hour period, it's estimated that 10,000 different species are being moved around the world. Just in ballast water, this sort of mass invasion event is without precedent in our planet's history.
Yeah, that is a real, I think that's a very, very interesting, you know, phenomenon. How's that? Which I was not as aware of as I should have been when I started the book. Everyone's familiar with invasive species. They're a big problem here in California, agricultural problem. And many of us, you know, in our backyards have invasive species or introduced species. Like, you might have a flower or a plant that you brought from somewhere else. It's not considered an invader because it hasn't, you know, taken over your garden yet, but it is an introduced species. And when you think about it, right, we consider that really ordinary. There's this plant, you know, from South America. It's beautiful. Let's plant it. Or let's bring that animal over. Or we often do it unintentionally, as you mentioned, in ballast water from ships. We're transporting 10,000 species per day is the estimate. And we think of that, okay, well, that makes sense. It's ordinary. But when you think about it, right, obviously, like, a land animal can't cross water very easily. You know, there's a reason why, for example, many islands, the only mammals that they have are bats, which fly. They don't have any native mammals because how would a mammal get there? And, you know, ditto for marine creatures. They can't cross a continent. You know, now we have, for example, the Panama Canal. We are bringing species from one ocean basin to another. They have not been together, you know, for tens and tens of millions of years. And when you do that, you know, a lot of things can happen. One is that the creature that's been transported can't survive in a new place, right? So that's the end of him or her. Another is that they can survive, but they're pretty benign and they just, you know, sort of shuffle along and everything is more or less as it is. And a third thing that can happen, though, is that the new creature comes in and it's really got an advantage over some of the old ones, and it rips through them. It's either a predator or it outcompetes them and it takes over. And when you're moving around a whole lot of species every day, you know, it only takes a tiny proportion to be devastating to have really, really serious effects. And to get back to the frogs, what seems to be devastating frog populations, at least some of the reason why amphibians are in crisis, is because of a disease, a fungal disease, that was almost certainly carried around the world by people transporting frogs around the planet. Mm.
I wanted to go back to Barbara's question about the lack of education and then the larger question, what needs to be done to get this issue more attention and to get the public to understand what we're actually facing at a time when you've got, you know, the political show in the country, Meet the Press, last Sunday had a so-called debate about climate change. David Gregory said, are the paralyzing storms in the East, the drought in the West, creating new urgency to take on climate change? I'm going to speak to two people on opposite sides of the issue, Bill Nye, the science guy, and Republican Congresswoman Marsha Blackburn of Tennessee. And then in December, you had the CNN's Don Lyman tweet, is climate change real? And, I mean, they're giving airtime to people like Mark Morano, who runs a climate skeptic website paid for by a fossil fuel-funded lobbying group. And he's sitting next to the Sierra Club's Michael Brune. So, I mean, this is CNN and NBC's Meet the Press having these so-called debates on climate change.
Yeah, it's not a happy situation, I have to say. And as a journalist, you know, as a citizen of the planet, I'm not happy about it. And as a journalist, I have to confess I'm rather embarrassed by it. And I think that, you know, the role of the press, to the extent that we, you know, have a role, is to try to inform people. And it's to try to inform people, you know, of even of things that they might not want to really, you know. And I think, unfortunately, one of the things that's happened as a lot of, you know, newspapers have folded and magazines have folded is increasingly the news is being tailored to what people really want to hear. And it's not necessarily that we're changing, you know, the planet. So I can't say I'm really, you know, wildly optimistic. And I really appreciate, you know, the opportunity to be on shows like this that are trying to get information directly to people who want it. And you know, to be honest, the reason I wrote the book was because I didn't think that people had the information that they need. So that's sort of, you know, the best I can do personally. But I don't know how we're going to cut through a lot of noise that's out there.
So what does that mean for the sixth extinction?
Well, it doesn't mean anything good. You know, I mean, one of the questions, you know, the obvious question that I leave readers with is, okay, you know, what are we going to do about this? You can say, well, we've been at this world-altering project, it turns out, actually for quite a while, unconsciously. And now, you know, now we have the information that we need to know that we are in doing something very dramatic and very serious that will have, for all intents and purposes, permanent consequences. And I don't mean permanent on a human time scale. I mean permanent, you know, in the history of life in this planet. But until, you know, we can people focus on that, until people, you know, recognize that, then we cannot even have any kind of conversation about what we could do about it.
And how do you answer that question? We just have about a minute left. You write that to argue that the current extinction event could be averted if people just cared more and were willing to make more sacrifices isn't wrong exactly. Still, it misses the point. It doesn't matter whether people care or don't care. What matters is that people are changing the world.
Well, that is, you know, I really wanted to give it to people straight. How's that? I definitely didn't sugarcoat it. Let's put it that way. And I'm afraid that's the fact. The fact is not how we feel about it. The fact is what we're doing.
Elizabeth Colbert is staff writer with The New Yorker and author of the new book, The Sixth Extinction, An Unnatural History. Elizabeth, thanks so much for coming in.
Oh, thanks for having me.
Thank you. And thank you for listening. Thanks for your phone calls and emails. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's your call. On the next Your Call, it's our Friday Media Roundtable. This week, we'll have a conversation with Aloof Ben, a veteran journalist covering foreign policy and national security and the editor-in-chief of Haaretz in Israel. Ben says that in Israel, stories involving defense, intelligence, or nuclear matters must be submitted to the military censor's office. So how do Israeli journalists cover the Israeli-Palestinian conflict? And what role do the media play in shaping public opinion about that issue? It's Your Call with me, Rose Aguilar, and you. Support for Your Call comes from the listeners of KALW. To sign up for our podcast or to share the show on Facebook or Twitter, visit yourcallradio.org. Malihe Razazan, Ali Budner, and Becca Hoekstra produce the show. Matt Martin is our executive producer. Phil Hartman is our chief engineer, and Joe Burke is the studio engineer. Our theme music was composed and performed by Live Human. Your Call is produced by KALW in San Francisco. Special thanks to our partners at KUSP in Santa Cruz. You can email us at feedback@yourcallradio.org.